This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 418 for April 27th of 2018, from Ford to Tesla to Mahindra. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right, another After Hours. Mr. Gary Vasilash.
How you doing, John?
I'm just doing peachy.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So, you know, I always do a number later on in the show. And while I was looking for numbers, I came upon a number that I know will be very important to some people in our audience, that according to the International Organization of Vine and Wine, that 2017 was the lowest wine output in 60 years.
So that means prices are going to be up.
Prices are going up, down 8.6%. So for those of you who have a thirst, wait till the show's over. Then go to your local wine store.
Go out and invest in a case.
Interesting number, though. Yeah. Lowest in 60 years.
Okay, we got to let everybody know.
No, for wine output.
Yeah, time to go buy a couple cases, it sounds like, right?
Okay, hold on. First, the introduction so the audience knows who's here and talking. We got Henry Payne, car critic for the Detroit News. Always good to have you here.
Yeah, good to have you.
Later on in the show, I want to hear about your track testing of the Corvette ZR1. I know you've written about it, but
day.
I want to hear it right from the horse's mouth.
That's a good day at the office.
But we got to let everybody know, too, that our special guest for the day is Rick Haas, the president and chief executive officer of Mahindra North America. And Rick, welcome to the show.
John, thanks for having me. It's really this is really going to be fun.
So let's just set the stage with a little bit of your background, because I think it's fascinating. You really are a car guy. Where'd you start your career out at?
So, look, it depends on if you want to start after I graduated or before, because because in high school, a couple of buddies and we started a little car mechanic organization for our school, and we were fixing the teachers and the cars at our high school. And so it kind of started there and even before that. But when I graduated, I started working for Ford. That was in 81, and I stayed with them, and I was in Japan and Brazil through that time, 6 years out of the country, and I ended up leaving the Ford system in 09, and then I joined the Tesla system, worked there for a few years, 2009 to 11.
And doing what there?
I was a director of engineering for the Model S. And then Mahindra and I had been talking for a while at this point, 5 or 6 months, and I finally decided to pick up and move from San Francisco to Chennai.
And Chennai, India.
India, yeah. And I was there till the middle of 2013 and then came back to start the business here in the United States.
So how did you hear of Mahindra?
So, you know, it's a couple of ways, right? So you may know that back in the 90s, Mahindra and Ford had a partnership, and Mahindra was building vehicles. I think it was Escort in India for Mahindra. So I was at Ford when that was going on, and as it turns out, one of the people that I worked with was involved in that project. So that was the first time I'd ever heard of the company. And then, of course, that project went its course, and then you don't hear about it again. But when they called me in San Francisco back in late 2010, when we started the conversation, I sort of knew who they were because of this prior relationship. And I said, my recollection is people think fairly highly of this company, and so let's have a chat. So that's kind of how it went.
It sounds like you went to India for more affordable housing. Much more affordable than Silicon Valley.
It's all true.
So you go to Mahindra. Yeah. They've kind of made a name for themselves in the U.S.
Yes.
Right now with their tractors.
Yes.
But then they started doing what? Side-by-sides as well, right?
Yeah.
Off-road kind of vehicles.
Yep.
And there was a contract manufacturer.
Yes,
wasn't there?
Intimidator. And
they're in Arkansas. Yeah.
And so they still have that relationship. So the tractor group started in the United States in basically in 1994. And look, if you indulge me for 30 seconds, it's kind of a funny story how they got started,
yeah.
Right? And they tell this every year at the National Dealer Meeting. So when Mahindra got started in the United States in the tractor business, they kind of sent a tractor in a container here, and a guy named Rip, that's his first name, picked up the tractor at the port and loaded it into a trailer on the back of his truck and drove it around until he sold it. And then he called back and said, hey, I sold the tractor, send me another one. And I'm not making this up. Rip still works for our tractor group, and they introduce him every year because he's kind of the guy that started it.
So that's
how the company started. It was sort of one tractor at a time until there was enough traction to start to do more around that. And, of course, it's been 25 years now. And, you know, of course, I think Mahindra now in the ag space is number three in the sub-120 horsepower tractor category in the United States. And I think they're still the fastest growing brand here in the U.S. So they've done really well in the last 25 years for themselves.
Okay. Then they said, Rick, why don't you go back to the U.S. and do what?
So, you know, the original idea, Mahindra is a very interesting company. It's like a federation of companies rather than a company with a bunch of divisions. And so the original idea, and John, I had talked to you before, about a year before I came back, there was a need for some internal expertise. And so we set up a very, very small office in the Detroit area. It was five people. A couple of those folks came from Tesla, a couple from Ford. I had one guy from Kuala Lumpur. And we set them up in a small, we kind of muled an office that Mahindra, one of their businesses, already had and said, hey, do you guys have five desks and a payroll system I can borrow? So we set these five guys up back in 2012 when I was still in India to provide internal consulting. And these guys were true experts, right? Some of the senior guys from the Tesla team and some other folks, right? So that was the ended up being the genesis of this. And so when I came back, the idea was that we would grow an engineering organization of global experts such that as Mahindra starts to prepare for a global expansion, there's enough people in the group that have that kind of experience that you don't start stepping on your toes, right? So the original idea of the whole company was we would be a satellite engineering organization that was focused on global product. And we started immediately working on an eight-passenger MPV. It's called U321. It's now launching in India as we speak. It should be launched next month.
But it was what, engineered here?
It was all engineered, prototype, validated, signed off here. And, of course, I also mentioned that we have an apartment complex in Troy, and we were also sort of doing some cross-training as well as other kinds of training.
Why did they have you engineer and design it in the Detroit area, not back in India?
So the ecosystem here in Southeast Michigan, and actually we looked all over the world, we had to make a decision about where to put what we called the Overseas Technical Center, right? So we looked at Stuttgart, we looked at Turin, and we looked at Myra's got a big facility they put up there. They were trying to attract some folks. We looked at San Francisco, we looked at Tokyo, we looked at Seoul. And we looked at Detroit, and of course, I'm a Detroit native, and so I was advocating a bit for Detroit. But I said, look, everything you need is within a 50-mile radius of where we're going to locate. I've got universities with auto-centric programs. I've got the EPA is here. I got test labs. I got wind tunnels. I've got test tracks. I've got any kind of service in terms of prototyping that I could possibly need right here within just a couple of miles of where we're at. So why would you go anywhere else? And at the time, the Detroit area was just coming out of the crisis. And so I looked around and said, well, this not only that, it's a good deal.
Yeah.
So
Silicon Valley of automotive. I mean, you hear people outside of Silicon Valley starved for tech talent.
Right.
Right. That's they still go to Silicon Valley or they go to Utah because
right.
That's where the talent is. I mean, it's the same. The talent is here.
Well, in fact,
for automotive.
When I was out at Tesla, we would have to come back to the Detroit area to find people to go out there and work because aerospace engineers are great guys and they're really talented. But it's a different line of work. It turns out to be a different line of work. And so it took them some time to get used to doing things one a minute instead of one a year.
Or they just go to SpaceX and...
So, absolutely. So that was the original idea. And so that's what we started to do. And again, the first project, we actually started it with just a couple of people. I said, well, we got seven people here. Let's see what we can do with this thing. And the thing is launching now, and it's a great product. You'll see it. I can't talk any more about it. They still haven't unwrapped it, but we should start seeing some press on it in the next probably 2 months.
Wow. It's a large SUV.
It's not an SUV. It's actually a kind of a Euro-style MPV.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like a minivan.
Yeah, kind of, but you know, not the same.
Not minivan. I know what you mean by MPV.
They don't,
right?
they don't sell. If you go to Europe, you'll see stuff like Renault Grand Scenic, which is more of a car-looking MPV. That's what's expected in the India.
Yeah. Ford S-Max, sort of thing.
Yeah. So the sliding door thing is sort of associated with like a commercial delivery vehicle.
Right.
So you know, they don't play well in places like India. People think you're driving a delivery truck. driving stuff with sliding doors on it, right?
All right, so I went to the Mahindra Automotive site and, yeah. and counted 18 different vehicles from that Mahindra has. Now, are those vehicles not global in nature? Are they engineered for India, and that's why you guys are in Detroit, because you're developing for the world?
So that's more, look, I couldn't have said it better myself. Those products that we currently sell were designed for Indian, India-like markets for the most part. Now, we do sell some things in Chile. We sell a few things in Australia. There's some stuff sold in Western Europe under certain heavier duty categories where the regulation is a little lighter. But those products in general were designed for lightly regulated countries. And so as we move forward, the first step is to expand is to get a bunch of product that I can sell anywhere at any level. So the United States, Western Europe, in all categories and so on, right? So that's the idea of putting a center in Michigan was to help make that happen faster.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let's come to the product that's sitting here in the studio, the Roxor. Tell us the story behind this. How did you decide to do this vehicle?
So it's a story, right? We started with an engineering center, and a lot of the people that we hired were really looking for an opportunity. There's a lot of people in our industry that have worked almost their whole careers. They've got all this expertise, and the traditional large OEMs tend to compartmentalize people in a way that doesn't necessarily let people show everything they can do. So you've got these people that are getting near the end of their careers, they're in their mid-40s, early 50s, mid-50s, and they're like, you know, I really want to do something more. And so I've gone and plucked all those people out and said, hey, come and work here. We'll give you an opportunity to really show what you got. So everyone in our group is kind of out there trying to figure out how to move the business forward. So as we started to work on the MPV, people have said, well, look, part of this is a global expansion, right? So why aren't we also thinking about how we can help the global expansion happen? And so all kinds of people on my team started throwing ideas at me. Well, we can do this, or we can do this, or we can do this. One of the fellows that works for me, his name's John Pacella. He's a sportsman, and he runs our studio engineering and industrial design group. And he said, you know, this India-based Thar make a pretty good product for the U.S. And I said, look, I can't sell it here. It was designed in the 30s, right? I'm got emissions and safety and all those other things. It's not going to work. But he said, no, that's not what I'm talking about. It's a perfect off-road product. So I went away, and I got all kinds of ideas, but that was the one that stuck with me. And I sat down for a while, and I thought, you know, I'm going to soak on this. And after a while...
He's in India, or he's in this
office?
He's
here. Yeah, he's here in this office. Yeah. And so, in fact, we worked together at Tesla, which is where I met him.
Yeah, he's part of this engineering team you put together.
Yeah. Right. So I soaked on it for a while, and I thought, you know what? That's not a bad idea. It's a way to test the market with an iconic product that we made for over 70 years now in a space that's not quite automotive. And we came up with a way to do it at a sort of a moderate cost. And so what a great way to test Mahindra's brand than to do it this way. And a lot of people have asked us, oh, why can't it go on road? Well, you have to start with a frame, you know, and then you start from there and you work your way up. That's what you need to do.
So, you know, right off the bat, this is not a street legal.
It is not.
Now, if you kept it to only 25-mile-an-hour streets, could you get away with it?
Well, look, the low-speed vehicle law, we've got a couple other things we're playing around with for low-speed vehicle. I think I don't want to market this as a low-speed
vehicle. So this would be like an ATV, a side-by-side, ORV?
Yeah. It's a side-by-side. It's strictly for the off-road category. But as it turns out, there's an awful lot of people with hunting properties and farms and ranches and all...
So, how big is the market in the U.S.?
So, believe it or not, there's actually two pieces to it. There's the off-road piece, which is getting up near 500,000 now and growing.
What? Half a million?
Right, and growing. There's a dozen people in it. Huh. And growing rapidly. And then there's the kind of other space where it doesn't have to have a roll cage. So that's the golf cart sort of space. And that's another 500,000 units.
Who else is in the off-road piece, the roll cage piece? Who else is in there?
So there's all kinds of people in it. So you've got Polaris and Kubota and John Deere and Honda and Yamaha and Can-Am.
They're this big? They're this size vehicle?
They are...
smaller, aren't they?
No, they're, believe it or not, go get one. They are.
Go look at a Gator from Deere. They're pretty big. Right.
So this vehicle is about 62 inches wide, so it's right in the space of where all those vehicles are at. And from a length standpoint, from a height standpoint, it's about the same. And from a length standpoint, we're about halfway between a single row and a double row. So if you look at a two-row John Deere and you look at a single-row John Deere, our length is about halfway between those two.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Thar. So Thar is one of the 18. Now, this vehicle is sold as the Thar in India?
Well, so it's not this vehicle, all right? Okay. So what we did is we used that product as a base, and we started to talk to ANSI ROVA, which is the regulating body for these. They're the industry group for these. The regulating body is CPSC, but the industry group is ANSI ROVA. And we started to look at what we were going to need to do to the product to make it legal and usable in this category. And so the changes are quite substantial. So how it ends up working out is about 75% of the parts from this are crated up and shipped from India. And we get them and we get
like, CKD.
Yeah, it's not exactly a CKD, because that would say you take a vehicle and knock it down, put it in a box and send it. This thing's done like serial production. So we get crates of bodies and crates of frames and crates of axles. So it looks more although they're all coming from the same source, it looks more like serial production. About 25% of the parts come from the U.S., and those are the things that you need to make the vehicle suitable. In fact, we had to make a left-hand drive is one thing we had to do. The roll cage has to pass some very severe tests in terms of tilt table test and rollover test. There's J-turn and other kinds of tests that had to be passed. So we've gone through this vehicle.
You've got the diesel engine. You got a diesel, it's 2.5 liter diesel in here.
Diesel in it, right.
Yeah, so do you have to do any downstream chemical plant stuff?
Yep. All,
that's all for the U.S.
We had to change the different calibration. The intake system's different. The exhaust system's different. It's got a spark arrestor instead of a muffler. That's U.S. Forestry Service guidelines for the segment. And so we touched every piece of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. So I got to make that clear when I talk to people. This is not a Thar. It is sort of derived from it, but it's a completely unique vehicle. By the way, I'd like you guys are all experts. Think about, can you come up with another example of a part of a vehicle being shipped somewhere and you add parts, local parts, then come up with a different vehicle than the one that was originally built? I think, it's never been done before, as far as we can tell. Think about it. If you could think of one, I'd like to hear the example, because we can't find another example of a vehicle that ends up being a different vehicle after you, right, after you do
it. It's been established in another country.
Right.
But now the folks who are looking at the video of this will see a very strong resemblance to a Jeep. And going back with the history of Thar, did you have a relationship with Jeep an English company early on?
So here's how it went. The Mahindra brothers back in 1946 had a steel trading company. And the fellow from Willis was Harvey Roos?
Don't know.
His name? The guy that was the start of the Willis company.
Yeah, way back to Willis, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was a guy, Barney Roos. Was their technical guy, mm-hmm. I guess. So anyhow, the Mahindra brothers started they met him and started to have conversations, and they said, look, the war's ending. You guys have these product. India's road conditions post-war are not too great, and so this is a perfect product for the kind of usage that we could see. Could we get a license from you to build them? So the license was granted in 1946. We started to make CKD, and literally they were knocking them down and stepping them in crates and sending them to us, and we would put them back together. 1947, we started that. So today, 71 years later, where the same manufacturing facility is still making the product, and of course there's been updates made. It doesn't look like the old classic, which is the World War II version.
Yeah.
We have one of those, and some of the old tooling's still around for that, right?
Yeah.
That's the one that even has a shorter wheelbase than this one, and it's got that funky, the front end comes in before it goes forward, flat fender, right, with the 11 barb grill. That was where we started. It eventually migrated to this level, and there was continued to be a relationship with Willis and then AMC and until the 70s or maybe late 70s or early 80s, and then...
That's fascinating because Jeep still keeps these old Army vehicles around as sort of their touchstone.
Right.
And you guys, basically, in India,
right.
There's a similar culture there.
Same thing. And so I think our license expired...
That's such a durable car. It's amazing.
So I think our license expired in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then we just continued to build from whatever that level of vehicle was. And I think we stopped updating it in the mid-80s. Whatever that level of vehicle was, we continued to build. So that's what this is. It is a very, very authentic vehicle.
And has Jeep come knocking on your door going, hey, wait a minute?
So we have agreements with FCA that are applicable in this case, and we followed them, and they know that. And so that's...
So let's
that was I think that was one of the changes, right? As you go to India and you see a... what do you call it?
Thar.
The Thar. It still has a 7-slot grill, that's right? Great. You bring it here, and now you got this new 4-slot grill.
So, again, we followed. We have legal agreements with FCA. We followed them, and that's what this product represents.
Yeah.
So you assemble this in Michigan now.
So it's, so we do all the assembly. A lot of parts come from the U.S., like that roll cage, that ROP system, roller protection system, comes from Watson down here locally. we do the painting here. We do the assembly. We do all the Line-X. And so
you're making them right now?
Yeah.
And they're on sale now?
Yeah.
Where do you buy them?
So if you look at our website, it'll tell you where the dealer body is. There's a few dealers. There's a couple dealers not very far from here. There's one up, I think, Grand River.
Okay, and what's it retail for?
The base price is $14,995. We're not actually selling that model yet. That's a steel wheel model. This has got aluminum wheel on it. So it's, I think, $15,549 with the aluminum wheel. So.
Okay, how are sales going?
So we're sold out.
No kidding.
And the question is, how much are we sold out?
You're sold out because you can't make them fast enough, or you're sold out because you're just swamped with orders?
Yeah, yes and yes. So we had a national. We did the unveiling on March 2nd, and then we did a national.
So you're just ramping up, right?
Right. So it's just been about 7 weeks, right? So then we did a national dealer meeting about 3 weeks later in San Antonio, where all of our dealers, prospects, and people that were already in the pipeline all came from all over the country and Canada. At that meeting, the dealers said, okay, we said, how many do you want? And they signed pieces of paper that said, this is how many I want.
These tend to be dealers that they're retail. I mean, they deal in multiple variations of
eight. Yeah. We put together a power sports network. And so, as you guys know, power sports is motorcycles, ATVs, jet skis, UTVs, snowmobiles, right, scooters. So that's power sports. They're all multi-line.
It's not the tractor sales guys.
No. So ag is a different kind of a venue. Most ag guys carry a couple lines of tractor, and then they might carry a line of UTV. Because of what we were trying to do here, we've gone to a complete power sports venue where we have lots of competitors that are in the same space, because what we want to do is get this thing out there and in front of people that want to buy one of these, not a tractor. And we're also trying to grow. We're trying to decide if this needs to grow into something like a full-fledged auto business, and that's a better way to do it than through an agricultural venue, right? So that's how we've started the thing. But yeah, so we've sold. It looks like it. Look, the dust is still settling, right? The plant is sold out for at least 1 year. The concern we've got is it's two.
Great problem. What's your capacity?
Orders are still. So we set up the facility to do 5,000 on one shift. There's a story behind that, too. And then 10,000 on two shifts, right? So so we've got more than 7,000 orders now just from that one event. And the orders are still rolling in chunks. So we think when the dust settles, it's going to be more like 14,000, 15,000. We don't know
yet. You do it on three shifts?
Look, what I'm looking for is a bigger plant site now.
Currently, the plan is you're just south of...
We're at 75.
You're just south of FCA headquarters.
Yeah, that's right.
Off of I-75.
Actually, if you stand in that building with binoculars, you can probably see what we're up to.
Yeah.
That's how we're at. We're in the old EDAG building, which is at the southeast corner.
Yeah, you can see it from the interstate. Yeah. And these are hand-built, or you got a line?
So,
you got robots in there?
No, so look, it's a manual. It's, there's a story, right? When we were trying to decide what the demand for the product would be, because the vehicle doesn't look like anything sold in the segment, nobody really had any idea. And so we started to ask people who were industry people and said, power sports people, and said, what do you think of this? And the numbers we got were, you know, they were all over the map. Oh, you're going to sell 100 of those a year. No, you're going to sell 20,000. So when the dust all settled and we did a bunch of research, we said, okay, this could go anywhere. We're not sure, right? There's nothing to compare it to. So we settled on 5,000. And we said, look, here's what we're going to do. This is a moderately priced assembly operation. There's no robotics in it. It's all manual, including the paint system.
We'll get to that in a minute. Good for you guys, yeah.
Right. And so we said, look, if the volume turns out to be a couple hundred units, well, we haven't pissed away a fortune. And if the volume turns out to be 25 or 30,000 units a year or something like that, some enormous number, we haven't spent so much on the equipment that I'm going to feel bad if I have to walk away from it. So we kind of balanced it off with the company and said, look, this is the best we can guess at it. Well, we weren't so far off, But I think when we start to talk about different models, because these are all manual transmissions, mm-hmm. the automatic doesn't launch till later. We think that doubles the volume again. So so for now, we're kind of keeping an eye on it. We're looking for a bigger site, and we'll see what we how we're going to monitor the sales very closely. But right now, it looks like to be a complete, we're completely sold out.
Hey, we got a couple of questions here before we wrap up the segment. Miro Keffert wants to know, how do you convince NHTSA and the EPA and CARB that this vehicle will only be used off-road and never driven on public roads?
So, you know, that's a very good question. It's a very good question, and we spent a lot of time agonizing about that. We're not dumb. It hasn't gotten past us that this looks like something you might drive on the road. And, in fact, there's some very old vehicles out there that kind of look a lot like this that are on the road now. So the regulating body here is actually CPSC for this classification of product. It's not NHTSA. And so we did talk to NHTSA about it, and we worked with CPSC, but in this case, it's the EPA that makes the determination. They are, because these are CPSC vehicles, and NHTSA is not technically involved, and we got a letter from them that said, yeah, if you're going to do a side-by-side, it's not us, it's these guys. But then the EPA steps in and takes on the role of, is this really an on-road vehicle in sheep's clothing, right? That's their role. And so we spent a lot of time talking to them about it. And we said, look, the last thing we want is for people to go. We're not encouraging people to put these things on road. In fact, we'll do everything we can to discourage people from putting them on road because we don't want to be lawbreakers. We want this vehicle to be clean and mean. So no turn signals, no clock spring, no wiring form, no windshield wipers, no defrosters, plexiglass windshield, no glass, speed limited to 45 miles an hour. And so on. So there is a whole bunch of stuff we've done to the thing. And I sent a letter back to David Swain, and I said, look, this is what we've done, right? We've done all these things. And so we're not encouraging people to drive them on road. And they said, okay. So that's how it went.
Okay, but Austin Holzman wants to know, are there aftermarket packages to make it street legal?
So, look, I'm not going to get into that because I have committed to everybody that I'm not going to encourage people to be a criminal. And because if you take a vehicle that doesn't have a VIN on it, because these vehicles don't have VINs, they have PINs, and you decide you're going to fake it into an on-road vehicle, you're breaking the law is what you're doing. You're a criminal when you do that. So the last thing I want to do is encourage people to be criminals. We've also talked to our dealer body who've also asked us these questions, and we said, look, you guys have got to we've got to all stay clean on this. I am very sure that there will be people out there that will try to do just exactly what you've stated. I am not here to help nor encourage, nor are our dealers here to help or encourage that to happen.
Okay, last question here. Joey's cleaning lady wants to know, how can a short wheelbase ute tow more than a Wrangler? He must have looked at your towing numbers.
So, I can't answer the question because I don't know the technical specifications of how Wrangler's set up. What I do know is we've done tests to standards, SAE standards, and we validated the towing capability of the vehicle that way. So I'm not.
And what will it
probably
tow?
Weight? I mean, this is lighter than.
Yeah,
a Wrangler.
Look, I think we signed.
That's a good point.
Look, you guys are going to stump me on this. I think we signed it off at 3,500 pounds.
Yeah, it's 3,490 according to your.
Okay, 3,500.
Yeah.
Look, Rick, we got to wrap this up now, but this has been a fascinating discussion. I got a feeling we're going to have you back on the show because I got to believe the Roxor is not the end of the story.
It's just the first stepping stone.
The foot in the door.
Will there be a car with a VIN coming from Mahindra?
So, look, I can't answer that question right now. What I am going to tell you is this. This is literally a litmus test for the brand in the space that's close to on-road to see how people react to the brand, to see if the brand has equity, and to see if people like our DNA. And what we've learned so far is that it's five thumbs up, right? So far, so good. Now, that opens some doors and closes other ones. But the doors that it opens are some pretty interesting doors. And so you'll be hearing more from us in the next couple of
years. The brand is Mahindra or Roxor?
The brand is Mahindra it's Roxor by Mahindra. Okay. So the name of the vehicle is Roxor, but it's a Mahindra product. And as you can see, it says Mahindra right on the front of the windshield opening. Yeah. So that's what we're up to. And, yeah, this has opened some doors for us, and we're now kind of in the throes of, look, there's six or seven different paths I can go down at this point. We're looking at all of them.
Well, we're definitely going to have you back on the show when you pick one of those paths to go down.
Right.
But, Rick Haas, President and CEO of Mahindra North America, thank you so much.
John,
very interesting.
Yeah, really appreciate being
on. It's been really good.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We got a lot more to talk about what's going on in the automotive industry. We're back. And this is the part of the show where we bring out Dr. Data. So, Gary, go at it.
All right, so, John, I got this number. I was thinking of you when I came up with this number, and when you see what the number is and you immediately guess what the number is, you'll realize what I'm talking about. So,
okay.
So, Carmen, could you please bring the first number up?
114.5
miles
and 412 miles. And it's a long road. So,
I think Katie had something to do with the long road, but So what might those numbers represent? Look at Henry jumping at the bit there.
For me, that 412 miles would be the range of a high-end EV, and 114 miles is the actual mileage I get when I drive it.
Yeah.
How about that?
I was about to say the same thing. 412 miles is the range, but when it's cold outside,
all right. You guys are both sort of in the ballpark, but not there. So you guys are in the stands.
Yeah. Not even close. Huh?
No. You're close, but okay. So bring up the answer. It's the median range for electric vehicles and gasoline vehicles. So 114.5 is a median range for electric vehicles, according to EVAdoption.com, in the median range of gasoline vehicles, 412 miles, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. So basically,
Right now, today. Know that EVs, they're going to add a lot
right
of range
now
in
today.
The next few years.
But so, as you can see, it's 114.5 miles because you told me this story last week about your adventure in a Nissan Leaf, which was just startling.
Oh, my God, it was terrible. Yeah, I don't completely really blame the Leaf, but, you know, I left my driveway. I was going to Lansing. So for those who don't know, for me, it's about a 70-mile trip there and a 70-mile trip back, 140 miles, right?
You didn't make it.
And when I pulled out of...
A little above the median range there.
I pulled out of the garage.
No way you make that.
And the range indicator said I had 150 miles.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I did the same thing. Not to Lansing, but I did a similar test.
So I turned on the HVAC, and I lost 6 miles like that. So I turned the HVAC back off, and I put on the intermittent wipers, and I lost a few miles that way. And I thought, okay, that's no good. So I turned the wipers off. And by the time I got halfway to Lansing, it was like, oh, my God, this is not good. By the time I got to Lansing, I should have had like 80 miles left. I had 35 miles left. Yeah. I thought, no worries, because I looked on the dashboard and it told me where I could find a charger to plug in. Well, the charger didn't work. So I got back on the dashboard and it said, oh, there's another charging station 0.8 of a mile away. I drove there. There was no bloody charging station there at all. This is just something that exists in this, you know, charging finder. So I went back to where this event that I was at, found an electric outlet, plugged it in at 110. Came back 3 hours later. It had gone from 35 miles range to 42 or something.
Yeah, you'll
like
get
that.
4 miles on an hour on 110.
And then my wife and I made it about halfway back. I was even thinking of just leaving the stupid car there. I shouldn't call it stupid, but anyway, we got
it's a great
back.
Great car. You just need to know where the charging infrastructure is.
But here's my point, Henry. If I turn on the HVAC, it will immediately adjust the range. If I put on the windshield wipers, it'll immediately put on the range. It has a temperature gauge. Why doesn't it look at the temperature gauge and go, whoop, it's 33 degrees. Forget this 150-mile range. That no longer exists. It's a 100-mile range.
Yeah.
And I throw this little nugget out for everybody in the EV world that their range finders should include whatever the ambient temperature is. In fact, I should be able to call up the navigation system, put in my destination, and based on whether it's raining, what the temperature is, or whatever it happens to be, it should instantly spit out a fairly accurate range. I don't think it'd be that hard to do.
Yeah.
And it would save a lot of people from range anxiety.
I think the Chevy Bolt does something very similar to that. It'll adapt to your driving style. And it'll start telling
you. Temperature.
I don't know about the temperature.
Temperature, as you know, is the killer of EVs.
Right.
Cold temperature.
That's right.
Is.
Yeah. I always assume 25% degradation in freezing temperatures, in weather under 40 degrees. I always assume at least 25. But the other thing I assume, I've driven a lot of EVs, is I generally driving it normally, not even crazy like.
You normally drive, right?
I normally drive. Yeah. Just drive it. Normally meaning normal Michigan driving, 80 miles per hour, 70 to 80 on the interstates, giving it throttle out of stoplights, that sort of thing. My general rule is you get 60% range off the stated mileage. So for a Leaf, that's going to be 80 miles for 150 range battery. And on top of that, is that it's very hard to charge these things all the way back to full charge. So the Leaf I had would only charge back to 138, because as you charge up EVs, the old filling the beer analogy, it's it fills slower and slower as you get to the top of the glass. And I never got I charged this Leaf for extended periods of time. I never got back to 150 miles.
Yeah.
I'd get to about 138 to start.
I charged it all overnight. It was fully, fully charged.
You were getting 150?
It indicated 150. Yeah. It never delivered that.
Yeah, I didn't get back there. And then you go 60%. So the range is really problematic. And in my story with the Leaf, I've done long range like you did with Lansing. But even within the Metro Detroit area, there are two CHAdeMO chargers.
Yeah, level three.
Level three chargers. That's right. So when I get an EV that's not a Tesla, Tesla has a lot more infrastructure here, surprisingly enough, than all the other EVs out there. But when I get an EV, your life starts to revolve around the battery.
It does.
And I look at Royal Oak, which is where one CHAdeMO is, and the other one is on South State Street in Ann Arbor.
No, there's another one. There's one 3 miles from here on Beck Road.
Okay, well that's new, because I don't know about that one.
That's been there over a year and a half.
And there's only, I don't know about that one, but there's only one charging stall. That's the other trick. There's only one charging stall in Ann Arbor and in Royal Oak. So if you show up, and I schedule my day, I'm going to go charge there. I'm going to charge for an hour. I'm going to eat dinner. My wife and I are going to find a nice place to eat dinner. When we come back, I'll get 80% of my range back. But if somebody's there on the stall, it lengthens your stay. So yeah. Infrastructure is a real issue.
Big issue. Totally agree. I will say, though, I don't want to completely diss this Leaf. It was a really nice car to drive.
Great car.
And it's way better than the Gen 1 version of the Leaf in every way, shape, and form.
Yeah.
So
looks better.
Even though my experience with it was horrible, the car is actually pretty good.
But it comes down to, as you say, Henry, the whole infrastructure. I mean, so what responsibility do OEMs have going forward in terms of establishing the infrastructure so you're not stuck saying, damn, I mean, this thing doesn't work. Now I'm out of luck.
Well, you know, it's like saying the OEMs are responsible for going out and building gas stations so you can fill up. They don't know that business. They leave it to somebody else to go build that infrastructure who can make it a thriving business and make something of it. Just like, the gas station guys have bought whatever franchise they've got.
But is it a little chicken and egg, though? I mean, if you're saying, you know, I want a certain number, a certain volume of EVs before I put down my money and invest in creating this infrastructure.
I always say that the great story of the Model T of Henry Ford was that he also created big oil. I mean, because you made a car with a Model T that was capable of going long distances and only cost and was affordable. It was affordable to a middle class buyer. Then you also, in parallel, you created the modern oil industry because the oil industry came in and saw the infrastructure opportunity.
So he was
Ford has nothing to do with that. But if you talk to historians and ask them about the oil history, they start talking about the Model T and Ford.
Yeah.
So I think it's the same with electric. It's a matter of the even better analogy, which is a modern analogy, is the cell phone industry. When I was in Washington, D.C. in the early years of the cell phone industry, and there were naysayers in D.C. who said, you know, there's no way these guys are ever going to compete against the baby bells. The bells are too big. Well, guess what? Everybody got a cell phone in their hand, and the cell infrastructure followed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
where are the baby bells today?
Exactly.
They're gone.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So just
absolutely
a couple
gone.
Of comments here. Jonathan Brown said, I should have called AAA and had them tow the Leaf home. Miro Keffert says, EVs are good and excellent for normal city driving, less than 40 miles a day. Why not just rent a car if you have to go over 100 miles? And that's a way to do it, but I just want to get in the car that's in my garage and go, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. and that gets back to your life revolving around the car. I mean, the glorious thing about the gasoline car is how convenient it is.
And Ashley Michelchi, I don't know if I'm reading that right. Sorry if I butchered your name, Ashley. Just took my i3 on a 400-mile road trip, DC chargers all the way. Yeah, so it gets back to your point, Gary. If the infrastructure is there, you can do it. But mm-hmm. And you know, certainly in California and some other places, there is that infrastructure. But this is a big country, mm-hmm. and it's going to take a long time to build that whole thing out.
Right.
It sounds like a joke I heard on the radio on the way over that Stephen Wright, the comedian, said, I went to a drive-in movie, I took a cab. Cost me $95. I mean,
that's a good.
Well, let's go to the complete opposite end of the spectrum of this discussion, because Henry, you got a chance to take the new Corvette ZR1 out on a track. What track, and what do you think of the car?
Yeah, what a neat car. As cars at that end of the spectrum always are. We went to Road Atlanta. I tested the Corvette Grand Sport, which has the standard 6.2-liter engine in at 455 horsepower at Atlanta Motorsports Park. There are two very good racetracks in Atlanta within an hour of each other. And I took that to Atlanta Motorsports Park 2 years ago for a test, and very good. Wonderful track car, but was borderline too much car for that track. And credit Chevy with taking us to Road Atlanta for the ZR1, because this is the type of car that you hear about these days, along with four GTs, Porsche GT, 911 GT3s, Ferrari 488s. That are, if you put proper tires on them, they're race cars. These are production built. Vehicles, full VIN, read street legal vehicles that are every bit as quick on track as race cars, and you're looking at a guy who was at Road Atlanta in November in a 1,000-pound sports racer, Lola sports racer, turning 1 minute 31-second laps. I was turning, you know, accounting for the sort of the pace that they put us through. At an industry event, as you guys know, you got to sort of...
You're not just turned loose.
Right, yeah, you're not turned loose.
You're following a pace car.
That's right, you account for that. I'm turning the same lap times in a Corvette ZR1. I mean, this is an extremely capable on-track car.
Were these street tires that you had?
These are the street legal tires. Yeah, I didn't even put slicks on them. I got slicks on my race car, which is not street legal,
right.
total race car. So this is a production car on street legal rubber, turning 130s at Road Atlanta, which is extraordinary.
And I think I should point out that while most automotive journalists think they're race car drivers, you actually are a race car driver, Henry. So, you really know what you're talking about when you do that.
Yeah, it was impressive. The pole time in our race, which was turned by a 20-year-old who races F2000 Formula cars, the pole in our race is 128. An equivalent driver, Randy Popst, who is the test driver for Motor Trend magazine, took this CR1 around Road Atlanta in a minute 26.
Yeah.
So 2 seconds under our pole time in 1,000-pound sports racers. I mean, it's a neat car. The difference is, I drove the 2009 ZR1, which is a legend in its own time. First CR1 that was done since 1990. 640 horsepower, extraordinary car. First supercharged Corvette, first Corvette that had carbon ceramic brakes on it. I mean, it had all the modern stuff. Extraordinary car, but boy, was it wild. I mean, it was like riding a bull, you know, a bar bull. And this thing, the new ZR1, was extremely well-behaved. It's a better chassis, but it also has 1,000 pounds of downforce, and that's the big difference. As you look at this car compared to the base car. Yeah, it's got 755 horsepower. Yeah, it's got big Michelin sticky rubber on it. But it's also got 1,000 pounds of downforce with a big wing and back. And that really makes a difference. Having that kind of downforce helping glue a 3,600-pound car to the track.
Cool stuff.
And then, and then you just drive it home like any Corvette. I mean, you guys have been in the modern Corvette. It is so comfortable inside. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's as nice as any luxury car. So you come off the track, drive it home. It couldn't be a nicer experience. I mean, it's the total package.
That's cool. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. A lot more things to talk about. But first, let's get this message from our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking all things automotive. And we got to talk about Ford because they dropped a bombshell yesterday. Although I think anybody who was paying attention was not surprised by this at all. They had been hinting all along that they were going to get rid of most of their passenger cars.
Yeah, I'm sad about it, actually. And I think there's huge risk in what they're doing. You're right. They've telegraphed this. They told us they're going to be selling 90% SUVs by 2020. Now we know how, because they're going to eliminate all their sedans.
So it's going to be the Mustang is going to be remained in something called the Focus Active.
But the Focus Active is a crossover. It's the equivalent of a Subaru Crosstrek.
But they basically, those are the cars that are going to remain in their lineup.
The Focus is going to come from China. And it's already been introduced in China. It kind of looks like a Mazda. Oh, here it is.
Is that the Focus Active?
Yeah.
I believe that's the
Active.
That the Active?
It's got the body cladding on it.
No, that's it. That's it.
Yeah.
And so to me, it kind of looks like a Mazda 3 or something like that. But, the Mustang will be the only car left here. They didn't say anything about Lincoln, but I think it's safe to say the MKZ is going away. And I think they'll keep the Continental until its platform product cycle is up. I don't see them investing to replace it. They can't even sell 1,000 a month of these things. So
yeah,
and that's what it's all about. I mean, sales of passenger cars are cratering.
But look at what the foreign companies are doing in this market, and they've taken substantial market share away from the big three in the last 40 years. They are all investing in new product in that space. Honda Civic, Subaru.
Let's see how long Impreza. That lasts.
No, but I'm just saying. This year, they have invested in new products.
Sales of the new Accord, brand new Accord, are down 20%.
But they're still selling 200,000, 250,000. I mean, that's a huge volume.
That is a huge volume. I mean, but guess what? If Ford was selling that many Fusions, it would still be alive today.
Right. But that's what strikes me is this is surrender. Right.
This is
the white flag. And the other thing that really concerns me, I mean, I'll give the audience my bias, too. The Ford Fiesta ST is on my top 10 list, best cars in the United States. I love that car.
I totally agree.
It's not only a great entry into the market for an affordable price, but it defines Ford's brand as a performance brand. You take that car away, you take away two things. You take away that initial branding that informs cars all the way up to the Ford GT at the $400,000 range. You take away that branding. Secondly, you take away any product in the market that is under $20,000. This the Ford Active that you just showed on the screen, that's a $22,000 car. So if you're an entry-level buyer with $18,000, you're going to buy Japanese or Korea.
Yes, but...
Or GM.
But... I'm asking strictly from a business standpoint. You've got this product line called the Fiesta, and it's got this cool car called the ST, and you lose money on every Fiesta you sell. Why would you invest another $1 billion to go and lose all that money, too? And that's what I think this is. It's a hard-nosed business decision that says, we don't want to give up these cars, but we can't make any money on them. So who's fooling who? We got to get out of this segment.
Yeah. But I just asked that question. How did you get to that place in your business model that you can't afford to do this, But Honda, Toyota, Kia, they can all afford to do it.
So far. I mean, look, you know, what's Hyundai say? What did Kia say? Oh, my God, we need a whole lot more crossovers because we're getting killed here. We don't have anything but too many passenger cars.
They're doing both. And Ford has said we can only do one.
Right.
I mean, and obviously what they have that no one else in this market has other than GM and Chrysler is they have trucks. So they make big money on trucks. So they don't feel like they need passenger cars. But again, I have real concern that they're losing that entry level customer. I have a friend of mine who moved from Chrysler to Honda recently, and I asked her, "What's the biggest difference between doing the two companies?" She says, "I love both companies. Both companies have great culture. The difference is that we sell 200,000 Civics a year. Chrysler and Dodge had no compact car. So we see new customers all the time coming into our brand. They get into our brand, they buy a Civic, they love it, and they start buying HRVs and CRVs and Pilots as they get families. The hard thing for us when she was at Chrysler Dodge, we don't get that first customer. Our first customer comes in the door when they're buying a minivan or a big 300.
So you're missing out on especially a lot of young people.
Yeah, you're losing your entry-level audience. That's a big risk for Ford.
So wouldn't the argument basically be the EcoSport will be their entry vehicle, and that's how it's going to work?
$20,000 car?
Yeah.
I mean...
$20,000?
So, I mean, I was looking at the numbers of the sales of the utilities that Ford has. Okay, that's what they're saying. So let's put the F-Series to the side. Okay, that's a phenomenon unto itself, right? But I mean, you look at the utility sales that they had, and I saw it and took out the 33,000 Sport Interceptor utility vehicles sold last year. So they had 763,227 vehicles. Okay, and that's accounting for the Edge, Escape, the Expedition, the Explorer, the Flex, right? Okay, but it just so happens that if you look at the utility sales of Toyota, it was close to 790,000 vehicles. Okay, so Toyota's outselling Ford in that space. And oh, by the way, you know, they sold 387,000 Camry last year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a big number.
It's a big number.
And I mean, we're still talking about a four-year business plan here, right? What Ford announced goes through 2022. That Fusion may come back. They're talking about white space cars. I mean, again, do you want to throw away the brand equity of Taurus and Fusion? I mean, they've spent millions, hundreds of millions of dollars establishing those brands in this market. Are they really going to throw those brands?
What have they done to the Fusion since it came out? Basically nothing, right?
Yeah.
Well, look, this is probably one of the reasons how Mark Fields kept their earnings looking good, is not investing in the product like he should have been doing. And it wasn't just in the passenger cars. I mean, look how long they let the Navigator and the Expedition hang out there without really doing much to it. Mm-hmm. So, but I think there's a new reality. You know, in 2016 and 2017, just those 2 years, passenger car sales in the U.S. fell by 1.4 million units. They continue to drop. We haven't seen the bottom. It looks like the rate of decline is starting to slow slightly, but it's still plummeting. And you let this run another 3-4 years, and I believe Ford's not going to be the last one pulling out of a lot of passenger car segments.
Yeah, but again, I mean, just that number that Kerry just gave, 370,000 Camrys a year. You want to give up on that market? That is a huge number.
No, that's big.
Not only in terms of profit. Toyota's making money in that space.
Right.
But also in the
And they also have the Corolla that they're selling almost as many of.
That's
and
right.
then you've got the Accord, and then you've got the Civic. And I mean,
those are customers to the brand.
It's big.
Right.
It's big. But mm-hmm. remember, they used to sell 440,000 Camrys. I don't know. I'm going to say 5 years ago. I'd have to look it up to be exactly right. So they've lost a lot of Camry sales.
Mm-hmm.
And right now they've got a bump up with the new model. Let's see how long that lasts. And look, I'm not trying to say that everybody should abandon their pass car segment. What you running a business have got to do is look and see Are we making a return on this investment? And should we take this very hard-earned shareholder money and spend $1 billion knowing full well we're never, ever going to get a return on that money? And I think that dictates the answer is no. And you know, if Toyota and Honda and others can make it work, God bless them. Go for it. But it's pretty clear that FCA and Ford have said we can't do it.
So Ford is a truck company now, then?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Right, in the U.S. market. So the real question is, what are they going to give up on in Europe right now? And ironically, some
of
the
global platforms.
These are global platforms.
They're still making Focuses and Fiestas in other parts of the world.
Exactly right, and they'll continue to do so. But when I looked at it, they've got a little kind of crossover thing in Europe called the B-Max. Not selling very well. The S-Max, not selling very well. So I think we're going to see Ford cutting out other parts of its lineup, not just in the U.S. market, but elsewhere, too. And it all comes down to investment. It's sure you can make these cars, and maybe you even make a little bit of money. I'm guessing they're making money on the Taurus, because I think it's been in the market so long, the tooling's paid for. But are you going to spend $1 billion to come out with a new Taurus? I don't think they can afford to.
But can they afford... You know, as Henry indicates, I mean, can they afford to abandon their ability to get people into their vehicles? I mean, by having...
But you sell a Corolla today, you've sold a RAV4 in 10 years. That customer comes in, loves the car, buys another Toyota for their family.
You know, and
that's the customer potentially that you're
American
raising.
Companies, you know, for them long term is 3 quarters from now,
yeah.
4 quarters from now. You talk 10 years, and you know what they'll tell you? We're all going to be dead in 10 years. So who cares?
That's a big
Toyota, deal. You know, look, that's one of the problems of being an American company. You are forced to take a short-term look. If you're publicly traded and you don't get the stock price going, you're out as a manager. Japanese companies, Korean companies, Chinese companies... I used to be able to say European companies, increasingly, they're becoming more short-term oriented. But it's only the Asians now that take the long-term view.
So why did they say sticking with the Mustang is okay?
Oh, you make money on the Mustang.
But if I mean, they didn't sell that many. I mean, it's just like, I mean, do you realize, I mean, I looked at this. The Dodge Charger, which admittedly has 2 more doors than the Mustang, I get that. But again, it's a muscle car, as the Mustang is. It handily outsold the Mustang last year.
Yeah.
But there's this piece, and you know, I've on the one hand, I'm amazed that they're ditching these brands, Taurus and Focus. They put so much more money into. On the other hand, they know their truck and Mustang brand, and that Mustang brand is not just about muscle cars. They're translating that into a Mach 1 electric car. They're looking forward, and that's a big risk in its own right. Talking about cars that lose money right now, electrics hemorrhage money, and nobody wants to buy them. And yet Ford sees the opportunity to leverage that Mustang badge into what they think is an electric future. So they're keeping that brand.
Yeah, and you know, you got to look at their global footprint too, because U.S. sales don't tell the full Mustang story. I want to say they're doing something like 20,000 a year outside of this country. And when you look at the GT and the GT350 and the convertible and, you know, all the other permutations, I'll bet they're making a decent return on their investment in the Mustang. And so...
So like I said, so all in 82,000 Mustangs last year.
Global.
No, in
so
U.S.
So it's probably about 100,000.
Global's over 100, yeah.
But
probably about 100,000 total.
Okay, so... They sold 209,000 Focuses last year.
But again, you got to look at transaction prices. And I don't know what the average transaction price for a Mustang is, but I'll bet you it's easily $10,000 a unit over what a Focus is.
Yeah, and again, I just think that's so much a part of who they are. That's why I think it's the sedan thing is a real risk, because I think that same DNA populated the Focus. I mean, John rightly talks about the big erosion in sedan sales. You know what sedans have been selling in the last 5 years? The hot hatches, ST, RS, Focuses. Those sales have been up. What does that get you? That gets you motorheads like me who then go out to their neighbors and say, And the neighbor says, wow, what is that? That's an ST. How much is that? Well, that's $35,000. Oh, that's kind of expensive. No, it's not. You can get a regular Focus for $20,000, for $17,000. Oh, you know, it's that buzz, it's that word of mouth
right.
that auto people give. You're getting rid of that by getting rid of the Fiesta ST and the Focus ST. That's a real risk.
Okay, we got some comments here from our viewers. Jonathan Brown says that Ford and FCA are following Isuzu. Everett Mish says, just like they did with
Isuzu?
The...
Isuzu? Yeah. Aren't they gone?
No. Isuzu still sells trucks in the U.S. market.
To who?
They sell very few. Honest to God, I want to say they sell like around 400 pickups a month.
Wow.
Yeah. Everett Mish says, just like they did with the Wrangler, a four-door Mustang could really take off. I'm not sure I go with that. But to your point, they're coming out with that Mach 1 EV. That's Mustang-ish.
Yeah.
So they're doing that.
A powerful name.
Jim Kelly wants to know, does this mean Ford will not move forward with the electrification of their vehicles? No, they are going to move forward with
electrification. Well, because they're so utility-heavy now, they're going to have to electrify to cover themselves in terms of, you know, whatever happens with CAFE.
Right, and that was part of this announcement. At the same time, I mean, you know, and it's hard being an auto company these days because you got with the customer once, and then you have to build with the government once. The AXE, the C-MAX, as part of this sedan downsizing, nice little
hybrid
plug-in,
which nobody bought.
So what do? In the same announcement, they commit to electrifying every model in their lineup going forward. That means you're going to electrify all the way up to things like the Explorer and the Expedition.
You bet.
I mean, those are not going to get the commensurate fuel economy that you get from a smaller, lighter car. So that's, you know, those could be money losers.
You know, you basically look at, you know, what is Ford's reputation been with hybrids and you know, EVs, and not been doing all that great.
Well, actually, they're the number two hybrid brand in the U.S., second only to Toyota.
Right, but look at the delta between
I hear you. I'm just saying that, they don't have that great of brand recognition for green cars, but sales-wise, they do better than everybody except Toyota.
Mm-hmm. But again, that's another curious piece, is the brand recognition they've gotten in California by selling the Fusion Hybrid, which is now going away, really helped them in California. I mean, that's a market that all three of these Detroit companies are desperate for visibility in, and the fact that the Fusion beat the Camry in fuel economy gave them something to get a foothold in California. So, is that going away? You know, I mean, you just look at the cadence here from Nasser to Mullally to
Hackett,
and there doesn't seem to be a lot of continuity. Nasser got, you know, Nasser was a very 30,000 feet new auto company guy. Mullally came in and checked him and said, whoa, you guys got to get back to product, you got to get back to your core, you got to start making the Taurus again. Now we're right back to Nasser again with Hackett talking about becoming a new autonomous company, getting rid of all our sedan product. I mean, it's a little bit of whiplash between these last three administrations.
This is why I think Ford needs to change its board of directors, because of exactly what you're talking about. They just bounce and bounce and bounce. They bring in a different CEO and go off in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
I hold the board accountable for that kind of inconsistency and variability.
So by the time all this happens, Mr. Hackett will probably be gone. So, you know.
Okay, a few other things before we wrap up. Bobby and June Cox say, I can see why sedans are not selling. New sedans have poor visibility and trunk space that's almost unusable. They go on to, I'm paraphrasing here, our 2003 Lincoln Town Car has great visibility and an enormous trunk. Whipgood says, aren't the tamest CUVs simply pre-World War II high boy styled sedans? Kind of see that. Kinda. And we got a phone call. Carmen, let's bring that in. Somebody took the trouble to call. Let's bring it in.
Hi, great show, guys. Just wondering, when do you think Ford will discontinue these cars like Fiesta and the Focus? I'm just wondering, if is it a year away, 2 years? Thank you very much.
Yeah, good question. I'm going to say 2 years.
I mean, my guess. I mean, I heard before this announcement that we were going to get a new Focus, because the new Focus is out in Europe. So my understanding was we were going to get a new Focus beginning of 2019. So
isn't that the Focus Active?
No, this is the regular Focus sedan and hatchback.
So sounds like we're not getting that.
Well, or maybe we're going to get that last tail. Because again, where the Ford is talking here about 2022.
No, remember, they were building them here in Michigan, and they were going to move them to Mexico, build a whole new plant in Mexico. Then that plan got scrapped, and they decided, no, we're going to take it to China.
That's right.
So that's what we're doing, is we're going to get this Chinese Focus Active or whatever it is.
And that's by 2020, so that's not that far from now.
No. But as I say, in the meantime, they're producing hundreds of thousands of Focuses for the European market and for foreign markets. So will we still get a taste of that?
I doubt it.
You know, again, that's a healthy bit of volume for them, for bringing customers into the brand right now. Fiesta, I get. I mean, the Fiesta actually didn't get introduced in this market until just recently, back in 2008, I want to say, when everybody thought gas prices were going to go to $4 a gallon. You know, again, this is the risk.
In 2008, gas prices did go to $4
exactly.
a gallon.
That's right. And then they didn't, and then they dropped off. I mean, to me, again, this goes to the continuity thing. I mean, who predicted in 2000 that 60% of the auto market today would be SUVs? Nobody. Who predicted in 2008 that gas would be $2.50 a gallon today, 10 years later? Nobody. So I look at the continuity of Corollas and Camrys and Accords, and I say, you know, they've stood the test of time because customer taste. And here you have Ford making this radical move away from badges that have served them pretty well over the last 30 years.
I can't argue with that.
They are selling. They're promoting those bicycles, though, so let's not lose sight of that, Henry.
Hey, look, we've got to wrap it up now, but Henry, thanks so much for coming on.
John,
always,
Gary,
always
great
good
to be
have
with you.
Yeah. And Gary, good to have you here. Who do we have next week? Do you know offhand?
No, I don't.
Dang it. We should announce at the end of this show who's coming on next week, because I know we've got the schedule. We'll get it out. We'll do plenty of promotion, but want to thank you guys, and of course have to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.